This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a Crimean referendum stirs passions. Ukrainians fight back in an information war. Is it time for a new Western approach to the crisis in Syria?
So far, the United States has taken a top-down approach to managing the Syria crisis, and we're advocating quite the opposite.
Dramatic testimony highlights the first week of the Oscar Pistorius murder trial. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Witnesses and Western analysts say thousands of Russian military personnel have crossed into Crimea since last week, setting off a groundswell of Western condemnation against Russian President Vladimir Putin and warnings of stiff penalties if Moscow fails to withdraw. Here is VOA correspondent Elizabeth Arrett.
Russian and pro-Russian forces in Crimea continue to consolidate their hold of the region, reinforcing barricades around Ukrainian military bases and scuttling a ship to block the Ukrainian Navy. The military actions come as a political showdown looms over the future of the Ukrainian autonomous region. The local pro-Russian parliament called for a referendum in just over a week on whether Crimea should break with Ukraine and join the Russian Federation. Lawmakers have already unanimously approved the measure. Ukrainian, European, and U.S. leaders have all denounced any attempt at secession, calling it illegal under Ukrainian and international law. President Obama spoke at length by telephone with Russian President Vladimir Putin late Thursday. Obama argued there's still time to resolve the dispute diplomatically. In a statement afterward, Putin said Russia couldn't ignore Crimea's calls for help and is acting within international law. Crimea has an ethnic Russian majority and long historical ties to Moscow. And with Russian soldiers and pro-Russian vigilantes roaming the streets, fear is rising for those who want to stay within Ukraine. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Simferopol.
Ukrainian UN Ambassador Yuri Kamenko took the floor of the Security Council Thursday to denounce the illegal entry of Russian armed forces into the territory of his country.
We are confident that with appropriate backing of international community in guaranteeing the sovereignty and territorial integrity of my country, as well as in resolving uneasy economic problems, Ukraine will keep the difficult but right track we are back on.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, has called for an independent international investigation into human rights violations in Ukraine.
These include killings, disappearances, arbitrary detentions, torture, and ill treatment. I strongly believe that respect for human rights norms and standards, building a society that is inclusive of the rights of all, is key to finding a peaceful and durable solution to the current crisis.
Ms. Pillay said a senior human rights officer has been sent to Ukraine and other staff members would follow. VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshna spoke with Sergei Khrushchev, son of former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, about the situation in the Crimean region.
Crimea is a Ukrainian peninsula, home of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, which allows Moscow to extend its military presence throughout the Mediterranean. The majority of its population is ethnic Russian, a quarter is ethnic Ukrainian, and about 12% are Crimean Tatars. For centuries, Crimea was part of Russia, until 1954, when Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev gave the peninsula to Ukraine, at that time a Soviet republic. Khrushchev's son Sergei says the decision to give Crimea to Ukraine had to do with economics and agriculture. The building of a hydroelectric dam on the Dnieper River that would irrigate Ukraine's southern regions, including Crimea.
As it is Dnieper and the hydroelectric dam on the Ukrainian territory, let's transfer the rest of the territory, Crimea, under the Ukrainian supervision, so they will be responsible for everything. And they did it. It was not a political move, it was not an ideological move, it's just business.
Khrushchev says it made sense to have one entity responsible for the building of such a large project.
Now we have the speculation that it was my father wanted to satisfy Ukrainian democracy, that even that he made a gift to his wife because my mother, because she was Ukrainian. All this have nothing with the reality. It was just economical issue and not political.
Crimea is now under complete control of Russian forces. Russian officials say the move was to protect ethnic Russians living on the peninsula. But Western officials say there is no evidence that Russians need protection. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry described the takeover as an incredible act of aggression. Tensions rose between Moscow and Kiev last month after Ukraine's pro-Russian president Viktor Yanukovych was overthrown by a protest movement wanting closer ties with the European Union. More than 80 demonstrators were killed, and Yanukovych fled to Russia. Khrushchev says there are no parallels between what is happening in Crimea and the 2008 war between Russia and Georgia over its two breakaway regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia.
In the 2008 war there, the President Saakashvili tried to restore control over these two rebel regions using force, and they attacked them, and Russia fought back. It was war.
Right now, says Khrushchev, no shots have been fired in Crimea.
And I hope there will be no shooting, because nobody interesting there in fighting. And the Ukrainians military who are serving in the Crimea, they're Crimeans, and they don't want to start fighting, and that will be against the interest of their own people and their own country. And I think the Russia also don't want to fight. Why they have to fight?
Looking ahead, Khrushchev says giving Crimea back to Russia is not an option.
I don't think so, and I hope it's not happened. And I never heard from Putin that he wants to do it.
However, lawmakers in Crimea have scheduled a referendum on joining Russia for March 16th, a move that will escalate tensions even more. Andrei Dineshin, VOA News, Washington.
Kremlin-controlled media have launched an information war to justify Russia's seizing of Crimea. But slowly, Ukrainians are organizing to counter Moscow's version of events. Jamie Detmer reports from Kiev.
When Russian soldiers seized the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea last week, Moscow launched an aggressive propaganda campaign to justify its intervention. It claimed troops were dispatched to defend ethnic Russians, and it accused neo-Nazis and extremists for the earlier ousting of its ally, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych, whose downfall triggered Russia's military intervention. Coping with the aftermath of a revolution, Ukraine's interim government does not have the media resources to counter what it says is Moscow's skewed version of events. Most new ministers do not have press offices. But ordinary Ukrainians are trying to counter the narrative offered by Kremlin-controlled media outlets. Part of that resistance is taking place at Kiev's Ukraine Hotel, where a crisis press centre has been set up by a group of Ukrainian private sector public relations experts. Faleva Alina, the chief executive of a public relations agency, explains.
When the invasion of Russian troops started, we all just were shocked. And we understood that our government is just quite young. They have a huge number of problems, huge, and they don't have a time even and to pay attention to informational protection of Ukraine. And we started to call each other and saying that we need to do something to protect Ukraine and to give the more independent information, more reliable information, our point of view.
Fralava says the center is not government funded.
This is absolutely voluntary. All people who are working here, this is just professionals in PR, advertising, communication, international relations.
The Crisis Center does not offer its own informational narrative, serving instead as a platform for Ukrainian politicians, activists, business people, and visiting international officials to hold news conferences. What they say is then reported in news releases and on the center's Facebook page and Twitter feed. This week, the U.S. State Department blasted Moscow's propaganda effort, arguing that the world has not seen such startling Russian fiction since Dostoevsky wrote, "The formula 2 × 2 = 5 is not without its attractions." 18-year-old Sviat Uslav Yurash agrees with the U.S. State Department's claim. He's one of many Ukrainians seeking to use the internet to launch initiatives to confront Russia's state media. His website, Euromaidan PR, was set up in January to document the protests against Yanukovych. But now he and his friends focus on Crimea and the standoff with Russia.
We are trying to provide more facts to highlight the truth behind what is actually happening in the east and in the south and in Crimea.
Yurash's website was quick to debunk Moscow's assertions earlier this week that tens of thousands of ethnic Russians were fleeing Ukraine. He points out that this week an anchorwoman on the Russian television station Russia Today quit the station.
Russia has started a campaign of blatant lies. We had actually today the news of one of their anchors leaving their job because she couldn't handle it anymore. I mean, you can lie only so much.
With tensions mounting over Crimea, the propaganda battle is likely to intensify. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
The key to ending the crisis in Syria is a better understanding of local players and power dynamics, according to a new article called Zooming In on Syria, Adapting U.S. Policy to Local Realities. We asked its co-author, Faisal Aitani, at the Atlantic Council, what they mean by that.
What we're trying to say in the policy brief is that so far the United States has taken a top-down approach to managing the Syria crisis. And we're advocating quite the opposite, a bottom-up approach that starts with recognizing that really in Syria, the war is a series of micro-conflicts that differs significantly from even on neighborhood level, the regional level, the city level, and therefore that the fabric and nature of the opposition in those places differs significantly as well. And any attempt to solve the problem as a whole without addressing it part and parcel or parsing it out, if you will, rather, is going to be futile.
Well, in the past, there's been some issues about who exactly are we dealing with in Syria. Are these future terrorists? Are these the good guys or the bad guys? How do you sort it out?
It's a very information-rich and knowledge-rich environment. There are what you would describe as good guys or bad guys, depending on the ideological threshold you have for what constitutes somebody acceptable to work with. There are still moderates in Syria. They are not by any means all jihadist transnational terrorists. So, you know, it's a complicated picture, and these groups exist across a broad ideological spectrum.
One of the things you suggest is pursuing military and financial assistance to the opposition. How would this work?
There is the advantage that Syria is, for example, unlike Afghanistan, adjacent to two countries that are essentially U.S. allies. So the geography is favorable. There are regional players that are indeed eager to provide more military aid to the opposition, and yet, to some extent, they're being held back by the United States due to U.S. concerns about the proliferation of arms within Syria and who might get what.
And do you think we should be taking advantage of any ceasefires that might happen?
Yes, I think, I mean, look, you know, I think it's important not to mistake these ceasefires as real meaningful truces. These are, to the most part so far, capitulations by the opposition, particularly in the area around Damascus, where the regime tactic of siege and starvation has been quite effective. The ceasefires, for example, around Homs that allow for temporary humanitarian relief, sure, I mean, these are good things in themselves because they relieve some suffering, but I don't think they should be mistaken as progress towards any sort of broader reconciliation.
Do you think that the international community is not really responding right now to what's going on in Syria with all the crisis in Ukraine?
Yes, that's probably true. I think to begin with, if by the international community you mean the West and its allies, there was always a deep ambivalence towards the uprising in Syria and never a total commitment. But I don't anticipate that the Ukraine crisis would detract significantly from Russian commitment to the Syria conflict, or Iranian for that matter.
And you think it should be now that they should take action in Syria?
Absolutely. I think the situation gets worse as we speak. The regime's position improves, and the nature of what's going on in the rebel-held territories gets worse and worse for the Syrian people and for their neighbors. So I think it's already late.
Faisal Aitani, resident fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, speaking with us from his offices in Washington. His article is called Zooming In on Syria, Adapting U.S. Policy to Local Realities. The long-awaited murder trial of South African sprinter Oscar Pistorius began this week, bringing with it drama and explosive testimony. In this report for VOA Television, Anita Powell goes over the highs and lows of week one of what has been called South Africa's trial of the century.
The first week of Oscar Pistorius' murder trial has delivered as many twists and turns as the runner's own dramatic story. The once-celebrated athlete, who grabbed the spotlight for being the first double amputee to compete in the Olympics, is fighting a murder charge for shooting dead his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp, last year. He insists he mistook her for an intruder when he shot her through a locked bathroom door.
The first count against the accused, count one, is one of murder.
Judge Thokozile Masipa will decide his fate along with two assessors who have legal training and who will help guide her judgment.
Do you understand the charge?
I do, my lady.
How do you plead?
Not guilty, my lady.
Thank you.
Witnesses gave dramatic testimony that they heard screams and what they took to be gunshots from the athlete's home on that fateful night.
It was a bit longer. As the second and the third and the third and the fourth squad.
Just after her scream, my lady, I heard four shots. It was four gunshots that I heard.
Did that have any effect on you?
It was very traumatic for me. You could hear that it was blood-curdling screams, and it leaves you cold. You can't translate it in words, the anxiousness in her voice and fear.
Pistorius has remained calm through most of the proceedings and has been supported by his close-knit family. Steenkamp's mother, June, also attended the first day of the trial and told British broadcaster ITV that Pistorius refused to return her intense gaze. Some experts predict the trial could take months. Oscar Pistorius is no stranger to obstacles, but this is the biggest fight of his life. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
An Israeli-based program says it's increasing its efforts to help children in Ethiopia with congenital and rheumatic heart disease. The project called Save a Child's Heart works with children of all ages around the world. In Ethiopia, it will be working with the Black Lion Hospital in Addis Ababa in a move to treat an additional 50 to 75 children a year. One of the group's board members, Jeff Hoffman, explained to VOA's Kim Lewis how the program reaches children whose families cannot afford the surgery needed to save their lives.
We screen them in Ethiopia, children that need heart surgery, and send them over to Israel where they stay in a children's home, sometimes with their mothers, depending on their age, and they receive heart surgery, and they have a few months to recover, and then they're returned home to the care of the physicians that referred them. Right now, we have kids from many different countries in Israel receiving treatment. We serve about 250 to 300 children a year. Usually half of those children are Palestinian children, and then the other half are from Africa and other countries. Right now we have children from Palestine, Ethiopia, Ghana, Romania, Iraq, Tanzania, and several other countries. They receive surgery, and then they go back home.
Does your organization look to working with hospitals to make sure that they are staffed appropriately for children with heart ailments?
We currently have a couple of doctors from Ethiopia in training. We are training several Palestinian doctors in pediatric cardiac care so that they can build a cardiac unit in Ramallah. So our goal is eventually to help build capacity in different countries so that they can do the surgeries within their own country. But it still takes a long time to train these physicians. We just completed training of a Tanzanian pediatric surgeon. He was in training for 5 years in Israel. Just went back to Tanzania a few months ago, and he is now the first pediatric cardiac surgeon in the country, 50 million people, and is developing a cardiac care unit in Mwanza, Tanzania.
What types of cases do you all treat?
They treat heart disease, both genetic and, you know, those that have developed over time. Well, many cases are due to rheumatic heart disease from untreated rheumatic fever. In many countries, there's not adequate treatment for that. Some are just genetic abnormalities, holes in their hearts, and other problems. So it's the full range of cardiac problems that children have. Sometimes, if they're very extensive, they may not be able to travel to Israel for that surgery. But whatever cases we think we can handle, we'll bring over and repair their hearts.
What types of challenges do doctors face in treating children with heart diseases and heart ailments in countries such as Ethiopia?
First of all, the problem is prevention. So you have many children who just go untreated, as I mentioned, with rheumatic fever, and simple course of antibiotic could have prevented the heart problem in many cases. But children go undiagnosed, or they don't have the, especially in rural areas, that don't have very good medical care. So there's a big problem of heart disease that develops, unfortunately, that could have been treated. And one of our goals is to see improved prevention in these countries where there's early diagnosis and treatment with antibiotics of strep throat and rheumatic fever that can lead to heart disease in a small number of cases. Then you need to have facilities to treat heart disease, and you need a full surgical team with all of the equipment that's necessary. And you need to have expertise not only in heart surgery, but cardiac care, intensive care, anesthesia. So there are several different components to treating heart disease, and many developing countries are in early stages of developing that full range of capability. There's been a lot of progress in Ethiopia, and they do have a cardiac care unit that they're developing, and I'm optimistic that they will be able to do full range of care within the next couple of years.
Jeff Hoffman, board member for Save a Child's Heart, says the average price of treatment per child is $10,000. Home births in the United States are increasing, although they still account for only 1% of the overall deliveries. In Los Angeles, Dan Mosses has this television report on the rising interest in giving birth at home with the help of midwives and the efforts of some midwives to reach out to minority women.
Yes, this is where you're born. In here.
In 2012, Jasmine Lavender delivered her second child in a bathtub in South Los Angeles.
It was an amazing experience, very empowering. I'm encouraged to support other moms and to get in their vaginal births. It was life-changing, to be honest.
She chose to give birth in an informal setting because she feels like the hospital performed an unnecessary and rushed surgical procedure, a cesarean section, when she delivered her first child.
I was just on a time clock, and my time was out.
The tub where Jasmine gave birth is located at the community birth center. The women who work here specialize in maternity care, but founder Rashaw Lawler says they also offer some general health services.
It's seeing ourselves really truly as a clinician where, you know, as a midwife, you can draw people's blood and you can test people's blood and you can check people for STDs. You can, you know, teach women about how their body works in regards to their ovulation and their fertility. So why not make sure that everyone in the community knows that?
Lawler is a licensed midwife. She went to this woman's home to help her give birth.
How much longer?
Not long enough, not long enough.
After the birth, Lawler continued to provide services to the mother and her newborn son. Midwife apprentice Tanya Smith Johnson says the center believes in keeping the process as natural as possible.
We do things to keep women from, you know, tearing. We'll rub oil, you know, as opposed to like, okay, you tore and we're just going to suture you up, no big deal, you know, or we're going to cut you, you know, that kind of thing. You know, we do all the things to make it as, you know, as few interventions as possible.
Smith Johnson is one of Lawler's apprentices. When the center first opened, there were about 300 licensed midwives in the state of California. Most of them were white. But Lawler hopes to double the number of midwives of color through advocacy and free mentorship.
The stats show that women of color were the ones who need maternity care. Our babies die at rates, you know, 3 and 4 times that of white women. And one of the solutions to that is having more women of color tend to women like themselves.
With generous donations and flexible client rates, this grassroots birth center provide services to people who otherwise could not afford them. Dion Moses, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 7, 321, the Roman Emperor Constantine I decreed that Sunday would be a day of rest in the empire. In 1274, St. Thomas Aquinas died. The 13th century Dominican friar, philosopher, and theologian was posthumously named a Doctor of the Roman Catholic Church. He is renowned for his proofs of the existence of God, believing that both faith and reason lead to truth. In 1876, the U.S. Patent Office issued American inventor Alexander Graham Bell patent number 174465 for a communications device for transmitting vocal or other sounds telegraphically. The telephone developed out of Bell's improvement to the telegraph. 3 days later, Bell successfully tested the telephone transmitter. On this day in 1936, Nazi dictator Adolf Hitler sent the German army into the demilitarized Rhineland, a mineral-rich territory west of the Rhine River. The move was in direct violation of the Versailles Treaty ending World War I. On March 7, 1965, civil rights marchers demonstrating for voting rights for black citizens during a protest march from Selma, Alabama to the capital, Montgomery, were assaulted by state and local police. Television coverage shocked the nation. In 1971, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman delivered an historic speech to a huge crowd gathered at a Dhaka racecourse. He said, "This time, the struggle is for our freedom." A war with Pakistan followed, and later, freedom for his new nation, Bangladesh. In 2006, the terrorist group Lashkar-e-Taiba coordinated a series of bombings in Varanasi, India. At least 28 people were killed. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Rape is often used as a tactic of war, intentionally terrorizing and brutalizing entire communities. And although women and girls are by far the most common victims, men and boys are also frequently assaulted. Given that the legacy of sexual violence and conflict can cause long-term instability, addressing impunity is part of the process for restoring peace. Rape and sexual violence are not inevitable byproducts of armed conflict. In recognition of this, last September, 140 countries, including the United States, pledged to do more to support prevention of sexual violence and conflict when they signed a declaration of commitment to end sexual violence and conflict. By signing, we made a solemn pledge to prevent and respond to sexual violence anywhere and everywhere, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and William Hague, British Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, state in a recent opinion article they co-wrote for the Huffington Post. That's a start. Now it is time to begin taking steps to eliminate this scourge. First, every government, every country, must hold those responsible for crimes of sexual violence accountable for their actions. And this must happen at all levels of responsibility. We must end impunity, not only for those who directly perpetrate such acts, but also for those in positions of power who order or are otherwise responsible for such crimes. But too often, such crimes are not reported and thus cannot be investigated due to stigma felt by survivors. Ending impunity, therefore, begins with shifting the stigma and shame from survivors to perpetrators. This means an enormous education effort. It requires a great deal of political will, and it can only succeed with the full participation of men and women working together. And women should be a part of the dialogue on human security issues such as these at the highest levels to help bring a level of personal experience, credibility, and reality to the debate, said Secretary of State Kerry. Our goal must be to end this cycle of violence once and for all, wrote Secretary Kerry and Secretary Hague. It is time for every citizen in every nation to stand up against sexual violence. Now is the time to act.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.